You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, the weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients while having a great work-life balance. In addition to our premium courses on the Effective Statistician Academy, we also have lots of free resources for you across all kinds of different topics within that academy. Head over to theeffectivestatistician.com and find the academy and much more for you to become an effective statistician. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the ever-growing video on demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. Head over to the PSI website at psi.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today.
Hello there, and welcome to the Effective Statistician Podcast. And today, we have a very special edition. We don't just have one guest, we actually have three guests. And not only that, they're statistical methodologies, which is a subject which is close to my heart as well. And in a moment, I'm going to get them to introduce themselves. But just to say that this podcast is being recorded due to the publication of a paper entitled Statistical Methodology Groups in the Pharmaceutical Industry, which has just been published in Statistics in the Biopharmaceutical Research. And a link to the paper will be included in the show notes. So I am going to ask people to introduce themselves in turn.
Hello, everyone. I'm David Wright. It's great to be here. I'm the head of statistical innovation at AstraZeneca, based in Cambridge in the UK. I lead a team of expert methodologists and other statisticians based in Cambridge in the UK, Gothenburg in Sweden, and Gaithersburg in the US.
My name is Jürgen Hummel. I'm a methodology statistician at Cytel in the Statistical Consulting Group. I previously headed up a statistical methodology group at a CRO, that was PPD, now part of Thermo Fisher, for 7 years, and also at a large pharma company, Novo Nordisk, for a year and a half. And I've worked in the industry for about 30 years overall, originally from Germany, but I've spent my entire working life in the UK.
I'm Jenny Devenport. I'm a statistician by training. I worked in diverse settings for a long time, public health, device and drug development, at medium and large companies, in individual contributor roles and in leadership roles, and obviously most recently in methodology leadership, really just dedicating my career to ensuring that appropriate methods are available to solve problems that matter.
Perfect. And as I mentioned in the introduction, there's this paper that's just been published. And I wonder if you could just give the listeners, not just me, some top line headlines of the paper. But not only that, just give me maybe some sort of summary of it.
What we were trying to do with this manuscript, which has been authored by the FSPI Statistical Methodology Leaders Group, is to explore the remit and value of dedicated methodology groups, the organizational considerations that are necessary to address and maximize impact, the characteristics that methodologists need to influence speed and efficiency in drug development. And our goal here was just in general to address what these groups do, why they are needed, and how they add value. Jürgen or David, do you have anything to add?
No, I think that's a very good summary overall, Jenny. And it was really good that you were the main drive behind putting that forward. And I think what we were trying to do from our group is explore the similarities in how we were setting ourselves up and also where maybe some of the differences. For example, I work both in a large pharma setup and in a CRO setup. And there's a lot of similarities in the sense that people in these groups have a sort of really deep methodological background in there, but the focus areas, they may be slightly different. So in a CRO setup, it is typically focusing on client concerns to try and help them speed up maybe stages of development with innovative approaches. In a large pharma setting, that's maybe then targeting specific therapeutic areas more, the areas that the company is working in. And another sort of difference is maybe that in a CRO setting, it's often a bigger focus on implementation of published innovative approaches and tailoring them to the client needs. Whereas in a large pharma setting, there's maybe sometimes an approach of more working with in collaboration with academia in order to develop new methodology. So that is a more long-term approach that's maybe less common in CROs. Okay. David, any thoughts from your side?
Yeah, maybe just a little bit of thank you on the longer term aspect of what you were talking about. So yeah, that is important and can be a tricky part of our work is getting buy-in from senior leaders to have a sort of a three-year roadmap or a five-year roadmap towards success in the adoption of a new approach. The paper goes into details about how we have to work across from invention all the way into implementation. And of course, as you were alluding to, Jürgen, there are many different ways of doing that in big pharma or CROs. But in big pharma, we might be working a little bit more from the left-hand side of that equation, if you like. But we still also have to tailor what's developed to specific project needs, which is in effect very similar to what you're doing in CROs. So there's lots of similarities there. Maybe I could touch a little bit on the training aspect, which is a great opportunity that we have in big pharma because we have such a big audience. But obviously that also creates difficulties in how you can educate people or inform people across various different sites across the whole world, and then also drive that adoption so that you get not standardization necessarily, but the use of these methods in quite a broad fashion, which is what we're all after.
Fantastic. And that's some great aspects of just a general remit of what you guys do in both big pharma and CROs. I wonder if you could give me, or give the audience, I should say again, give the audience some idea of what's it look like to be a great methodology statistician and what would a typical day look like?
So yeah, maybe I can start by saying that I think the one thing that attracted me most to this area is that I wouldn't be able to say exactly what a great day would look like because each day will be different. So there's an amazing variety of what we'll be working on. So I think that's one of the things to stress, which I think is fantastic. So one great day might be where somebody calls you up or meets you at a coffee point if you're in the office and you have a short consultation with someone and immediately solve their problem. Or you might be spending a whole morning with a study team where you're addressing a very difficult problem that you've been working with them for maybe months or several weeks on. So that might be another part of the day. And then maybe you'll have other days where people don't contact you and then you're working on new methods or maybe writing that conference presentation and maybe making some corrections to a paper that you've written. So there's all of these different aspects that you might be working on. And I think that the only difficulty maybe that some folks find is not having that concrete knowledge of what they will be working on. I feel that's a particular strength of working in a methodology group.
I think what you mentioned there, David, about variety is certainly very true. And that's what I've experienced for many years. And ultimately, what I've found really exciting is being able to solve often complex problems. I've always been excited about adaptive designs, and they've really become a buzzword about 20 years ago. So what can be a great day is when you have a discussion with somebody who comes with a particular problem. And during the discussion, you then, as you drill into it, get an understanding of that there may be a solution that is around to help solve that problem. So maybe a particular type of adaptive design and the ability and then to see there's a path forward to explore that further with a wider project team, with simulations, with more details, and then to figure out there is a solution. And ultimately, when you see that then come to fruition and help the project team with the implementation of that, I think that is what I found most rewarding.
Maybe I jump in here too. I agree with both David and Jurgen that consultation can be extremely rewarding. That ability to collaborate closely with teams that are working on projects and help them solve new challenges that always seem to arise in drug development is important. But something that I also enjoy is how to take that problem and recognize that it's going to need scaling, and it could be even more impactful on the entire portfolio if everybody could do it. And so that process of developing education plans, of creating software, of creating subject matter expert networks that aren't just methodologists, but also project statisticians who can really help advocate and roll out the new methodology within a company so that everyone benefits and everyone feels a sense of ownership and responsibility for implementation. That to me is really exciting. And I think that's a special feature that a dedicated methodology group that's high functioning can offer.
And maybe I can build on that, Jenny. And maybe I'm going to be a bit controversial here, and hopefully not too controversial, though. There may be senior leaders out there that are listening to this that say, oh, yeah, methodology groups, fantastic. I get the idea, but they're a nice to have. How would you respond to those people?
So maybe I make a start. And this is heavily addressed in the introduction of our paper. Our industry has an innovation problem. And it's related to efficiency, and it's related to the high failure rates in drug development. The costs of drug development are driven very extensively by the different stages of trial investment. And of course, your biggest investments occur in late stage. But the latest statistics suggest that only 60% roughly of phase three trials are successful, which means there's a lot of room for improvement. So we have this innovation problem, and this is where methodologists and statistical thinking in general can help, is to help drive decision making. And so if you think that it's a nice to have, then maybe you're not willing to address this 40%, but it would be really good for drug development if we could.
If I add to that is, so I've spent most of my working life in a CRO setting, and it's probably fair to say that not many CROs do have a statistical methodology group. EPD and Cytel are probably exceptions in there. So many CROs focus more on the operational aspects of delivering study. However, I think that that misses an aspect that a lot of clients want to have an efficient way of running their studies. And if as a CRO, we can help them in that, then provides a head start for the actual operational delivery and running. So it's absolutely not a must-have in a CRO setting, but I think it does provide a competitive advantage by having that ability to do that.
Yeah, no, just to add to that, I think in Big Pharma, one of the advantages of a methodology group is that it can span multiple different parts of the business. Statistics is fairly agnostic to a particular therapy area. The people who work in particular therapy areas think that the methodology they work on doesn't get used anywhere else. But so we're able to make those links, and sometimes that can lead to advances in different areas or just awareness. We can translate one problem in oncology into one in cardiovascular, for example, or different areas. And so we can provide that link. And as Jenny was talking about, when we're deciding which problem should we scale, obviously we'd like one that's going to be broadly applicable across a whole range of different areas of the business. And then I think that offers a very clear way for senior management to see the value of methodology groups.
I'm going to mention an additional point that was brought up by our American Statistical Association colleagues in a discussion of the article. They and other discussants were advocating for an even larger remit of methodologists beyond clinical trials, in acknowledgement of the fact that a lot of different areas of drug development could benefit from statistical thinking. So decision making, which I already talked about a little bit, but also operations, which Jurgen mentioned. There are lots of different places where we could gain some optimization or some efficiencies, and that would benefit from statistical thinking. And different organizations choose to operationalize that differently. They may have their own groups that do that, but they may still benefit from the statistical knowledge of a methodologist from time to time.
And that last point, Jay, is a really interesting one, because I remember Andy Grieve talking about this when he first set up the group at Pfizer, talking about how he'd been involved with so many different interactions throughout the company. So I think what you've just said there brings all that back to the value of a methodology group. So if we think about the listeners now, and there's going to be statisticians who are young in their career, or they may be slightly more experienced, they might be sitting there thinking, how do I become one of these fantastic methodologists? So I'm going to ask you, what makes a great methodology statistician?
There's obviously the technical knowledge first and foremost. In order to be a good methodology statistician, you need to have a deep knowledge of statistics and what are the underlying assumptions of different approaches. What's the framework? What are the limitations? But then also the ability to adjust an approach as and when needed, rather than just applying it in a very specific way. So that technical skill is a great starting point, but I think it is only a starting point, because there's lots of other aspects to that. So Jenny, do you want to add on some others?
Technical skills are the starting point, but having a deep understanding of drug development so that you know what questions to ask and you know what might be practical is also important. Having the ability and the social skills to be able to interact with lots of different kind of non-statistician personnel is really important. Having a sense of curiosity about the basic science, about the medicine, about the different players involved, the intrinsic motivation to pursue problems and to pursue relationships, and of course, an extraordinary ability to collaborate. But David, I think you were ready to speak as well.
Thank you, Jenny. Yeah, and so listening to this sounds like we're looking for a unicorn or a sort of impossible superhuman. And so I'd just like to reassure the listeners that obviously we understand that people start from different places. And so just to emphasize that people in our teams come from very different backgrounds and have different paths to how they've joined a methodology group. So sometimes they're academics who then join industry. Other times they're people who've worked in projects for a while or for several years, and then they develop some of that drug development knowledge by being in those teams, but also want to go back a little bit to their sort of methodology roots, if you like. And so then they get the best of both worlds when they come back into a methodology group. So just to emphasize that everyone in the team is different, and obviously having a diverse team is very important. So it's very unusual to, or impossible for the whole team to have all of these skills that we're talking about at the moment. So it's a sort of be a team exercise to be able to do that. But Jenny wants to come in at that point.
I wanted to say, yes, we know that the environment is changing and that there are a lot of additional types of expertise that are coming into the quantitative array in pharmaceutical development. One example is software development, the open source revolution in the pharmaceutical industry towards using more open source software as opposed to licensed software to address innovative methods and get them implemented sooner. This is something that has come into play. And so some organizations have software development within the methodology group. Some of them have them somewhere else. And then, of course, there's also artificial intelligence, which is finding its way into different parts of organizations. In some organizations, they exist with the methodologists in an innovation group, and sometimes they sit in a parallel group. But certainly, perhaps there is benefit to those groups being synergistic, both in terms of the validation and compliance, and in terms of just realizing all the value they possibly can.
Thank you for that expansion of what I was talking about, which I obviously fully agree with. But I'd just like to say that one of the key skills that is relevant now as the world changes in an ever rapid fashion is, obviously, you would imagine methodologists will be very curious about new methods. That's a key part of their role. But obviously, as things come in from the AI side, I've been delighted to see several people just lean in immediately to understand how these new technologies are working, and to obviously be able to then provide expert guidance to various senior leaders about the value some things bring, and be honest, the less value that other things bring, which is a part of our role to be a trusted partner in those conversations.
And I actually had my next question around AI, which is quite interesting. And I'm wondering, If we were to look into the future, where would you see the methodology groups and AI working together? And maybe it's a case of where do the methodology groups have to evolve?
It's a good question. And maybe I make a slow start. One of the things that current models are very good at is automation. So when you already know what you need to do and you already know how to do it, you just need to be able to do it better, more and faster. That is a place where today's models can do a pretty good job of accelerating the work where there aren't as many questions about how to do it or why we're doing it. Obviously, that's not innovation, right? That's implementation, that's scaling. And so it's this innovation piece that we have to see how the models of the future perform and how they can support methodologists and other scientists in their work to accelerate invention, to accelerate adoption. I certainly see the potential of these new technologies to help with scaling and automation and adoption, but I think the jury is still out on innovation, but I'm sure that I can be corrected on that.
David.
Thank you. I'm not sure I'm going to correct you, but just to say that I think the important thing in 1, 2, 3, 5 years' time will be the driving aspect of organizations. So who is driving, essentially? You might say no one is because these automatic cars exist already. But I think the crucial component is that I think it should be people like ourselves and our teams that are driving the implementations, right? So by asking the right questions and then doing the research in the right methodologies and seeing how they can then fit in to the new technology rather than the other way around, because otherwise we run the risk of those looking at those technologies and sometimes them failing for reasons that we would readily be able to have foreseen if we were consulted. But we shouldn't sit back and just wait for that to happen, because we have to be big and bold and go for it. And then we have the chance to lead in those conversations.
And if we look at some aspects of maybe machine learning as well as artificial intelligence, there are approaches that are becoming more popular, for example, in modern covariate adjustment that are machine learning based and that do have the ability to make our statistical analysis more efficient. Some of the questions that we hear from regulatory authorities is ensuring that we still have a good understanding of what drives treatment effect under certain circumstances in specific populations or even subpopulations. So I think that is where we as methodology statisticians can really help, is try and get the understanding from the drug development perspective rather than simply the implementation of those approaches.
And I'm going to add on top of that AI issue, and you mentioned adaptive designs earlier on. My way of thinking is a human is a much better thing designing a clinical trial, particularly an innovative clinical trial, because an AI is only going to be working from what it already knows in the database. Whereas you might be thinking, actually, that's not going to work. And maybe this is going to work. Maybe this is more innovative. And maybe this is a better way of looking at this design. So to me, we've got to embrace AI. I'm not, the genie's out of the bottle. We can't put it back. But it's a case of working with it. And I think there are human things that we can do. And I certainly think designing an innovative clinical trial is one of those human things.
I'm fully with you there. And since you mentioned adaptive design, there is no such thing as one type of adaptive design. The ICH E20 guideline is out as a draft, and it already mentions many different areas, but there are additional types of adaptive design that are not even mentioned in a lot of detail in there, because ultimately what that you're trying to do is try and build a study design that addresses the main area of uncertainty that you have at the beginning of your study so that you can take corrective action if needed during the study, rather than just seeing the result at the end and finding out that, oh, this is not what I needed or what I wanted. In those situations, you're absolutely right, Alan, is the ability to try and understand where is that main area of uncertainty and how can I choose one out of many different types to try and address it.
Yeah, and just to add to that, it's a remiss of me not to mention the work we do and collaboration with regulators as an ex-regulator. And as Jürgen pointed out, even if people within the company think that they might be able to adopt various things, other people will be asking questions of a technical nature, which were the best groups to advise on. I think that's very important, I think, to flag up as well. I think there's a lot of scope there that obviously everyone will be learning about new approaches, and it will be a sort of a roller coaster ride as people learn more about them. Anyway, I like roller coasters, so that's fine. I look forward to the ride.
And maybe I'm going to move away a little bit here and just your three methodology leaders, statistical methodology leaders, just a guess, what percentage of companies, this is really difficult because there's obviously a lot of small companies. If you were to guess what percentage have statistical methodology groups, what would you say?
Can't give you an exact number, and statisticians hate guessing and gambling, but I would say that they're fairly common in large pharmaceutical companies and maybe less common in medium and smaller biotech companies.
I would completely agree. And if we then look further, I already said earlier that they're not very common in a CRO environment. Even amongst the sort of medium to large size CROs, they're not necessarily that common. So I think the biggest proportion is, you're right, in the large pharma setting.
And it makes sense, right? Because a larger pharmaceutical company is going to likely have a more diverse portfolio. They may be pursuing more complex targets, and so they may have more demands to streamline and centralize.
I've got to say, this has been a fantastic discussion, and I'm hoping the listeners will love this. But I want to go, as we're starting to wrap this up, and I know we've touched on it already, but what is the true goal of a methodology department?
I think ultimately what unites us is that we all want to make drug development more efficient. And I think that's been the driving force of the FSPI Stats Methods Leaders Group being established in order to help us jointly achieve that. Because if we are able to join force and maybe have help with the spreading of new methodology and helping with some of the discussions with regulators jointly, that is going to be a big step forward for all of us. So for me, that is the biggest aspect.
For me, ever since I started in statistics, I'm always looking to apply something, as it were. So if it was just theoretical and wasn't applied, although it might be beautiful and very clever, I would always be deflated in some way that hadn't been used. And so I think the biggest challenge that we face in the pharmaceutical industry is the slow adoption of very beautiful things. And so that's the most important thing and goal, is to speed up that adoption of these fabulous new approaches being used in the right situations, because as we've said, they shouldn't be used everywhere, just finding the right situations to use them. And so that's the beauty of the game, as it were, that we're in. And we just need to get even better at that, because as I've been talking about it recently, some of those things have been incredibly slow, which for various reasons. So we can make that those timelines much sharper, and then we can innovate more quickly.
And David, if I can probe on that, but how are we going to do that?
Better connections between various groups is one aspect, which we're all working on as part of the FSPI Stats Methods Leaders Group. And I was at an FSPI Stats Leaders meeting in Munich earlier in the week. So we're thinking about ways of doing that. So that it's partly those connections. It's also about better communication of methods, so we can clearly articulate them to non-statisticians in a better way. So I think if we do that, we've got the potential to vastly speed up the adoption of new approaches.
I'll take a little stab at it. The traditional academic route is you invent a new method, you write a paper, you present it at a conference, and then a miracle happens, right? Or everyone ignores it. But I think the goal of methods in drug development is deployment, not invention, right? So a concept that I have found really helpful is it's not mine, it's ours. It's not my method that I developed. It's our method that we're using together. And so where you see that play out in groups like the FSPI Statistical Methodology Leaders, our American Statistical Association counterparts, is the collaboration on specific topics. There are special interest groups dedicated to the kind of further development and implementation of specific methodologies, this collaboration that we don't have to do things alone. In fact, we'll be faster and more thorough if we do it together. So all of the steps of the innovation cycle benefit from collaboration, whether it's internally with project statisticians in your company, which is huge, or also externally with academics, with other statisticians in appropriate contexts with regulators. You can really take things further faster because inventions don't add value until they're adopted at scale.
Brilliant. And so you mentioned the F-SPY leaders and the F-SPY status. If listeners are listening to this and they say, how can I connect with F-SPY? How do you connect with the F-SPY leaders and the F-SPY statistical leaders?
The F-SPY have a website and there's details there, but it's the Stats Methods Leaders Group with contact names of the people that lead those groups. So that's the best way. Have a look there and contact the people that are mentioned there.
And Jörg and I will put that in the show notes. And how about the three of you? What's the best way to connect with youth?
LinkedIn.
Yes, that works.
Yeah, on LinkedIn.
I'm hearing nods from everybody. So I'd like to take a moment to really thank you for coming along to this edition. And like I said, a very special edition of The Effective Statistician. I know the listeners will be delighted with this episode. And actually, what I'm encouraging the listeners to do is if they like this episode, put some comments to say what you liked about this. And if there's any questions you'd like to ask Jenny, Jürgen, and David, then maybe put those in there as well and we can ask them on a future episode or in some sort of chat forum. So thank you very much. And I'm going to say goodbye and thank you everybody else for listening.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain and her team at VVS to help with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.